Record button, so we are live. How you been?
Good, good. Sounds like you've got that same cough I've had.
No, I just had something go down the wrong way, I think.
Oh.
No, I'm at least not yet. I have not had any kind
Oh,
of
thank goodness.
have you had a bad flu or a
Yeah, I got it at, I think I picked it up in Las Vegas when I got back to North Carolina. It was something.
Are you living in North Carolina? Is that where you're from?
Yeah, I live kind of in the middle of the state.
I think North Carolina is a very beautiful place.
I really like it. Both sides of my family go back hundreds of years here, so it's just where I belong.
Now, didn't you guys get hit by some of the snow as well?
We were down, we actually got down below zero for a little while, which is extremely unusual for this area. But yeah, we got, I don't know, 7 or 8 inches one day and a couple inches the next day. Yeah, kids were out of school for a week.
Yeah, we got hit by two snowstorms. It was kind of back to back, maybe a week apart. And now today was up to 60 and it's all melted. And now they're talking about another snowstorm coming across the
Oh
border.
no, coming
Yeah.
through again.
Have you
Oh
heard about
geez.
that? No,
No.
yeah. It's like, I think it's in Indiana, Kansas, that sort of thing right now. So it's heading across.
Oh boy.
Yeah, so we'll have to see how that all goes. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your websites?
Sure. I used to work as a financial crimes investigator for a Fortune 100 bank. So my job was two things. One, trying to track down who was committing fraud against the customers, but also against the bank. And so it dealt with things like money laundering. We had problems with people using our accounts to launder money to, for example, radical Islamic charities and funding terrorism and down to just petty credit card crimes, people stealing a credit card and using it to commit fraud, buy a bunch of stuff. So I was an investigator doing that, and I did that for years, and I enjoyed the work, but I hated the corporate world. So in 2012, I struck out on my own and decided to take my love of investigation. And I had been for a long time, about 20 years, I had been writing part-time as a part-time journalist. So I just decided to combine the investigation and the journalism into one thing and created my own business, doing investigations basically into stuff that I think is important. Child trafficking is a big one that I've spent a lot of time on, pedophile rings. But also just politics, geopolitics. I really love the geopolitics of the Middle East. I know for most people it's pretty boring, but I think it's fascinating. And so really since October, my main investigative work has been into the Las Vegas shooting. So I publish my stuff primarily these days in video format on YouTube. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/prepare333. But you can also find my some of my work on my website, which is blackstoneintel.com. And so my company name is Blackstone Intelligence. My writing used to be called End Times News Report, but I've rebranded. I've got a network of folks that feed me information around the world. So I just take what they give me. I vet it to the extent I can, and what I think is solid information, I'll publish. And that's pretty much it.
You should interview Cody Snodgrass. Have you heard of him yet?
I've heard the name, but I don't remember why it's familiar.
He was Black Ops, working for as kind of a contractor, not directly for the CIA, but for people that work for the CIA. It's kind of complicated. Yeah, he's come out with some just incredible inside information. I think he's back in the hospital, but Google for him, and he'd be a good person. You do interviews sometimes, right?
Yeah. I think I do. When you mentioned the hospital, and I think I do remember hearing about him.
Mm-hmm. You would probably enjoy speaking with him. I wanted to ask you about Trump, and I voted for Trump. But recently, he sold billions of dollars of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and I bet you spent some time studying that. I haven't put that much time into it yet. Do you remember how much he sold there? How many billions of dollars?
Oh, off the top of my, I think it was 100. I'm wanting to say 100 billion, but it was the biggest weapons deal in world history.
Wow.
Did I say 100 billion? It was $350 billion.
My gosh.
Largest in world history. And so they sold, the United States is selling Saudi Arabia tanks. We're selling them missile defense systems, cybersecurity technology, just a whole range of things are in this massive, massive package.
I think that's so
insane. I think originally it was like around $110 billion is what they told the public. And then we later found that it's well above that. The libertarian in me really has a problem with us, the U.S. government having any role in arming other countries,
right,
whether it's Donald Trump and the Saudis, or even, you know, back in the Reagan-Bush era with arming the Nicaraguans. I think people need, if the United States needs to get involved in a conflict for some reason, we should go in through the front door, fight it, win it, get it over with. But all of these backroom deals and, you know, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, the founding fathers really stressed the importance early on in having a kind of foreign diplomacy wherein we trade with all nations, that we keep open channels of diplomacy, that we act as friends to all nations, and that we avoid the entangling alliances that really kept Europe constantly embroiled in just perpetual warfare,
mm-hmm.
Largely because of the encouragement of the bankers over there. It was just constant between England and France, or just constant. And so our founders said, we don't want to do that. So we're not going to form these kinds of alliances where if you attack our ally, we automatically are going to attack you, even if it's not in our interest. But see, that's what we've done.
Uh-huh.
And this mess with the Saudis is absolutely not in the interest of the American people. But we're neck deep in it.
You know, I think it's very dangerous to sell the Saudis all of these excellent modern weapons, because that's what's going on here. We're not selling them junk. Instead, I mean, they're really getting some of the very best weapons. I think that's very dangerous, and we could be fighting against those weapons in the future.
Oh, that's typically how it works. Here we are fighting the Taliban still, and we armed them. We armed the Taliban. In fact, just today I had to drive down to Charlotte, and so I was listening to some political stuff on tape, and I was listening to Ronald Reagan's 1980 acceptance speech when he was nominated for president. And even back then, he was talking about how the Taliban were, you know, freedom fighters similar to our founding fathers, and why we needed to help them. And boy, did we get that one wrong. Because here we are over there. They're, you know, we're in a fight with them. They're killing our soldiers, and, well, more than killing our soldiers, they're killing the private military contractors that we are paying to go over there and do this work for us. But still, it's not in our interest. There's no American out there that can explain why we're still in Afghanistan after all this time.
Well, aren't
good justification.
Aren't they just guarding the poppy fields at this point?
At this point, that's essentially it. And yeah, you've got all of these tribal warlords, and they make their money from the poppy fields. The Taliban, when they took power, they put an end to that for the most part. And it was only after the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan that shifted. After we kicked the Taliban out of power, immediately the CIA went in and got the opium trade going again. And so, yeah, you see all these pictures of, it used to be primarily U.S. soldiers. You would see in these photos out there guarding the poppy fields. But that had such bad optics, and for other reasons, they started pouring more and more money into using mercenaries, Blackwater types back then. They have different names now, but I think it is at this point more than, it's somewhere between 60 to 70% of all of the combat troops in Afghanistan fighting for the United States are actually mercenaries. They're because it just, it in the long run, even though they get paid more individually, the U.S. government doesn't have to cover things like veterans benefits. And you know, if a military contractor, a mercenary, if they get shot and injured, we don't cover their insurance. We don't take care of them when they come home, like we do with, you know, U.S. soldiers. So they're making a ton of money. In fact, what's happening in both Iraq and in Afghanistan is, after our regular U.S. troops that get paid, you know, very, very low wages, they go over there and they fight, and they come home and they realize, I can make five times the same amount of money, or the five times the money doing the exact same work. And so they go back, but not as U.S. military. They go back as these military contractors and do the work. The problem with that, or one of the many problems, is that there's no oversight. And so while I'm not trying to knock these military contractors' ethics themselves, the fact is, they don't have to report in the same way that a soldier would. And so you have a whole lot more atrocity committed. The concern about civilian welfare plummets when you use these military contractors compared to actual U.S. troops. It's not a good thing. It's all business. It's basically a private army. That the corporations and the bankers are using to rob these different countries of their resources.
And who pays the salary of these contractors?
The U.S. government does.
The U.S. government.
Yeah, the Pentagon. Yeah, Pentagon budget.
That's insane.
So yeah, they go over there and it gets us into so much trouble, because For example, some people may know this, but right now, a big reason that there is ongoing contention in the Middle East is because there is an Israeli oil company called Genie Oil and Gas, or Genie Oil and Energy. They've got a huge, it's basically headquartered in New Jersey, and it has a board of directors that consists of eight people. These eight people are Lord Jacob Rothschild, who is, you know, one of the notorious Rothschild billionaires. Also on the board of directors of this oil company is former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney. You've got media mogul Rupert Murdoch. This is the guy who owns Fox News and the Wall Street Journal. You've got former CIA Director James Woolsey. And then you've got four other people who are all just big-time New World Order types. And so this oil company, what it has done, what they're trying to do is take control of the oil that is in Syria's Golan Heights. That's the section that's of Syria that's close to Israel. Israel took the land back in the 1967 Six-Day War, mm-hmm. and they've occupied it ever since. But there's no country on earth outside of Israel that acknowledges that that's Israeli territory. You know, it's just they're occupying it. Mm-hmm. But they won't let it go because it's full of oil. So what they're doing, what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing over there, is he is granting to Genie Oil all kinds of exclusive rights to go in and take the resources there. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that sitting just a few miles away from the Golan Heights border are thousands of U.S. troops. They're in Jordan, and they're sitting there nice and quiet, just there, but they're there to provide basically bodyguard services, to provide if Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, tries to go back and retake that section of the country, the U.S. military is on the ground and ready to go, ready to jump in there and repel them. While at the same time, up in the other part of Syria that is oil rich, it's their northeastern corner, that part has been taken control by the U.S. government. We've got control of that. Originally, what was happening was that the U.S. government was working on behalf of Israel and Saudi Arabia, trying to knock off this regime in Syria, because Saudi Arabia wanted to run a pipeline through Syria, but Syria is saying, absolutely not, you're our competitor, we're not going to, you know, give you easy access to the European markets through our territory. So Saudi Arabia and these other guys say, all right, well, USA, get in there and change the regime, put somebody in that's favorable, just like you did in Afghanistan. You know, we got rid of the Taliban and put in Hamid Karzai originally. And same in Iraq. We go in there, we knock them off and put somebody in that we think is going to be favorable to our what we want. So in Syria, originally what the CIA was doing was they took a bunch of mercenaries that we had been using down in Libya. We funded the U.S. State Department and the CIA worked together, using also with support from NATO, used mercenaries in Libya to overthrow the Gaddafi government and eventually assassinate Gaddafi. Well, once the government was overthrown in Libya and the Western banking cartel went in to set up shop, what they did was they took those same mercenary forces and they moved them around the past the Sinai Peninsula up into Syria and Iraq. And those forces, those mercenary forces, merged with the existing Al-Qaeda network. When those mercenaries merged with Al-Qaeda, that is how ISIS was created. The weapons that they were using in Libya to fight Gaddafi, those weapons mostly were left in Libya so that, because you couldn't transport the weapons along with them. Basically, it would be a whole mobile army, and you couldn't do that. You couldn't move them through Egypt and everywhere else. So what they did was they took the weapons, and to get those weapons back into the hands of those mercenaries who had moved up to Syria and Iraq, what they did was the U.S. State Department, Hillary Clinton, and also using the U.S. ambassador to Libya, they were operating out of two things. There's a U.S. embassy in Benghazi, Libya. Right next door, a mile away, was a CIA safe house where we had CIA assets there. And they were taking the guns that these mercenaries were using, and they were funneling the guns onto ships there in at the Benghazi port, sending those guns through the Mediterranean up into Turkey, where President Erdogan up there is completely complicit. He's a mafia thug is what he is. But they took the weapons in through Turkey and then brought them back down through the Turkish border into the hands of the awaiting mercenary forces, which was ISIS at this point. So the CIA and the State Department were working together to help ISIS try and overthrow the Syrian government.
Jeez, yeah.
But it didn't work. It didn't work because Vladimir Putin came in and said, you know what, we've seen enough of this. You're not going to get away with it. And so they started fighting ISIS and supporting the Syrian army against ISIS. And that's when things back from 2014 to 2016 got really, really dangerous, because we had the United States sending in our actual U.S. Air Force, while at the same time Russia had its military air force, both flying sorties over Syria, bombing each other's proxies, and it was very, very dangerous. Eventually, it kind of turned into a stalemate, and what happened was the U.S. shifted its tactic. The tactic before had been to take control of the entire country. Well, that Russia wasn't going to let that happen. So what instead happened was the U.S. threw its full support behind the Kurdish rebels up there, the Kurds, and they used the U.S. military and military advisors to go in there and fight with the Kurds, help arm and support the Kurds in taking control of the northeastern corner of Syria, because there's really only two places in Syria where there's tons of oil. That's down in the Golan Heights, which Israel controls, and then there's up in that northeastern corner. That's where the concentration of oil is. So the United States still ended up, in a way, defeating Russia in that, even though Russia stopped us from overthrowing the government, we still took control of the part that mattered, which was the oil territory. So right now, there is ongoing hostility because, and adding into the mix of all this confusion, Turkey, which is supposed to be our ally because they're a member of NATO, Turkey right now is in a war. They have actually invaded Syria this week, and they are fighting against the U.S.-backed Kurds, because they know that the Kurds are going to try and take a slice out of Turkey as well, and they don't want that. So it's just absolute chaos. Nobody knows who's on whose side. Everybody's at each other's throats. And the people that are profiting from all of this, off of the blood of the civilians, off of the blood of the troops, are the corporations like Genie Oil, which are funded and controlled by Jacob Rothschild, Dick Cheney, and others, and other military-industrial complex-type corporations that make money off the business of war. So all this is going on, and it's unbelievable to me that the American people don't seem to care what's going on.
I don't think they understand, and they don't know who to believe. And I'll ask you some questions and just to get your opinions on things. First of all, I think Bashar al-Assad, the leader of Syria, has been demonized. I don't think he's nearly as bad as our media portrays him as. What are your thoughts?
Oh, Bashar al-Assad is he's a pretty decent guy. He's Western educated. He was great friends with John Kerry, Senator John Kerry. Kerry used to go over to Syria and actually go out doing motorcycle rides with Bashar al-Assad. And this is right up until around 2011. There's even photos of John Kerry and his wife eating dinner as guests of the Assads. But once the powers that be said, no, Assad has to go. At that point, friendships be damned. Alliances didn't matter. Just you fall in line and you do what your masters tell you. And that's when we had to demonize Bashar al-Assad and act like he's the next Hitler, the new Hitler.
Well, let's talk about that, because isn't Syria one of the nations that's been put up for regime change? I think it's what the neocons that wrote out the project for the new American century outlined a whole series of nations where we would have regime change. Isn't Syria on the list?
Yeah, Yeah, that's correct. And General Wesley Clark, after 9/11, had a Pentagon source who is the one who told him about it, about this list. And people can go online and YouTube or wherever and look up this video. It's interesting because General Wesley Clark, who used to be the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO forces, he's saying it made no sense because the Bush administration, the neocons in the Bush administration, Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and the others, Donald Rumsfeld, they had decided that they were going to knock off seven nations, and it was going to start with Afghanistan, Iraq, and then Syria was one of the next ones on the list. It also included Iran and Sudan, and they've actually, and Libya was one of them. They've knocked off already. They've committed regime change in four or five. I can't remember already. But really, all of this is headed toward war with Iran. That's ultimately what this is all about, is a move toward complete consolidation of control over the oil resources of the Middle East. And as long as Iran is an independent nation, they're never going to have complete control. So war with Iran is absolutely inevitable. It's only a matter of when it's going to happen. But I think seeing the way that Donald Trump has really gotten on board with this Zionist plan to overthrow Iran, I think that it's going to happen in his first term. I think we're going to see war with Iran before the end of Trump's first term.
Well, let me throw this question out, because a lot of my information sources are saying that Trump will declare war on North Korea in February. Have you heard that?
I hear people saying that. I see no way that Trump can do it. There's just no way. I think that people, I don't know. I can't say, Mark, but my assessment of the situation in North Korea, because I've done a lot of studying of how war would play out, mm-hmm. and there's just no way that they could do it in a conventional war. The right. only thing they could do is learn in advance what the kill switches are, the dead man switch. What would happen if you decapitate the snake? Plan for that, and then go in with a small team and just knock off Kim Jong-un. Because if you have any kind of a conventional war, even if you do it, the Iraq shock and awe type thing where you just blitz them, it doesn't matter. They are just a handful of miles from Seoul, and the missile silos are all over the place there. And there is it's just a matter of seconds for them to get the missiles launched to strike Seoul. And we have between U.S. troops down on the 38th parallel, between the U.S. troops and their families who live there with them, there are over 100,000 American citizens that are right there on the border between Seoul and the 38th parallel. Seoul itself is so jam-packed full of people, it'd be like shooting fish in a barrel. So really, there's the reason that Donald Trump hasn't done anything up until this point, other than saber-rattling and sending ships in and everything, is because there's just nothing he can do. If he gets into any kind of military tiff, sure, we can beat them. That's not the issue. We could wipe them out, but the problem is the collateral damage would be so significant. I think the political backlash against Trump would be universal. I think that Republicans and Democrats alike would say, you just cost, when you could have tried ongoing diplomacy, you just cost the lives of 30,000 people. And there's no excuse. You could have done this differently. I think that it would be the end of him. I think he would be impeached, removed from office. And I just think he's too smart to risk that.
The original Korean War lasted over 3 years, I believe. So wouldn't this...
Yeah,
this one would probably be the same kind of thing, I would imagine.
They've come a long way since the 1950s, though. They learned they learned from the duplicity of the Americans, because it's blamed on North Korea. America started that war. It was the South Koreans, really, that were at fault here. The North Korean regime, yeah, it went on and it ended in a, you know, kind of a stalemate. But since then, the Kim regime they recognize they're going to do this again. The West is going to come in here and knock us off at some point. And that's why they're so incredibly paranoid. Incredibly paranoid. They're constantly watching for CIA operations to try and assassinate them. And so they get to the point of insanity. You know, it's like you read these people back in ancient times, the kings were killing their, you know, they'd kill one wife after another, they'd kill their own sons, kill their brothers, you know, they'd kill everyone because they were just convinced that they were going to be removed from power. And that's how the Kim family is. And so they have gone through extensive lengths over the years to build up a very, very powerful strike capability. And so it's a very different beast than we had back in the original Korean War. So they can hit South Korea hard, they can hit U.S. troops, and they can hit Japan. I mean, we've got so many allies who would lose a ton of people in a rapid exchange. That's why I'm saying the only way that the USA could beat North Korea without that massive collateral damage is if somehow the U.S. military and intelligence and the CIA was able to figure out how to neutralize those strike capabilities and then go in and snuff Kim Jong-un, take him out in a small operation, and then just let there be a transfer of power. There really would need to be a coup, an internal military coup against Kim Jong-un, because the military, if you've got enough generals and others in there that are, you know, against Kim Jong-un, they could prevent that kind of you know, big battle where North, because it would be suicide. Kim Jong-un knows that if it does turn into war, North Korea is toast. Kim Jong-un is dead meat, and he knows it. But the only thing that keeps the U.S. from going in is that he's got this one get-out-of-jail-free card, and that is he can do more than give us a black eye. I mean, he can cook us square between the legs and double us over in the opening moments of a skirmish, just with the massive collateral damage. Strikes against civilian populations. So really, in my mind, if Trump, and I'm one who I don't support the idea of impeaching Trump over all of these, you know, Russia and all this stuff, absolutely not. But if Donald Trump were to decide that the way to handle this is to go in guns blazing, I would support him being removed from office, because it's absolute insanity. Absolute insanity.
And maybe
you don't put the lives of that many people at risk. When at this point, North Korea is not a threat to the United States. Exactly. They have no desire whatsoever to fight us.
Exactly. And that's
they don't want to fight us.
That's what I wanted to say, because Kim Jong-un has not really attacked us. We would be attacking him first. We'd be striking first, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, it would be USA first strike. Kim Jong-un will never attack us, not unless we back him into the corner. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to provoke him. They're trying to get him to do something stupid. And Kim Jong-un, he's not as, yeah, he's crazy in a way, but he's not an idiot.
Right.
He knows that he will lose power. He knows that he'll lose his life. He's not suicidal. He doesn't want to die in a blaze of glory. He's a young guy. He wants to live his life. And so he has said over and over and over again, if you listen, if you read the messages when they're translated from Korean into English, read what he's actually saying.
Yeah.
He's actually making a lot of sense, which is, we don't want war. But we are going to keep pursuing a nuclear weapon because that's the only thing that you people seem to understand is brute force. Mm-hmm. And we will have that as a deterrent to stop you from doing to us what you did to Saddam Hussein. And he's got a point. The only thing that's stopping us is the fear of what Kim Jong-un can do to us. It's a deterrent. And it's not that I support North Korea having nuclear weapons, but I completely understand why. I mean, logically speaking, if Kim Jong-un does have a nuclear weapon, he's probably going to be safe for a while from Western. You notice that we're not trying to invade Pakistan,
right?
Which is a far, far greater threat to us. But that's because they've got nukes, and they'll fight back with nukes if we try and pull something.
Yeah, the whole thing with our media right now is so disgusting because they demonize Russia. They demonize Russia. And really, Vladimir Putin, I see as kind of a good guy in all this. What do you think?
Yeah. Russian TV has said that basically the CNN of Russia, like their biggest network over there, their state-owned network, they've sent a film crew to my house a couple times to film me for segments over there, which is funny because you watch it. They send me they send it to me, and it's like I'm talking, but then they dub the Russian over, and I just think it's funny. but they come because we talk, because I'm willing to like you, Mark, to have an open mind and say, you know, I know that our media says a lot of really bad things about Vladimir Putin, but the guy has really tried to be a peacemaker and de-escalate a lot of what the United States empire is trying to do around the world. They're not invading other countries. That people say, well, Vladimir Putin, he took over Crimea. Well, let's get the facts straight on that. George Soros funded and the CIA orchestrated a coup against the Ukrainian government. The president of Ukraine spoke Russian. A good portion of the people of Ukraine are ethnically Russians. So they have they're their next door neighbors. They've had a very long, good relationship with Russia over the years. So what happened, though, was that to try and take over the energy market in Ukraine, and among other things, U.S. Sources like John McCain, they were collaborating with oligarchs in Ukraine. They masterminded this plan with the CIA. They overthrew the government. They had a bunch of fake protests in the streets where it turned out later on, the evidence came out that there were neo-Nazis that were being funded by George Soros, these groups that went in that were shooting people on both sides. They were shooting the police, but also shooting fellow protesters to try and get the violence going. Eventually, they chased the government out of office. The president of Ukraine had to go into exile in Russia. And then the United States came along. And remember, these people, the Ukrainian government, they were elected in democratic votes. Mm-hmm. That the people went out and voted, and they chose through democratic election who they wanted to be their leaders. We went in, we overthrew their government, and the recordings are out there. One of the U.S. ambassadors had a phone call that was secretly recorded and leaked to the public where she, in advance of this coup, was already talking with her counterparts in Ukraine, selecting who their next president was going to be. And so that's what we did. We installed a new government that was favorable to the West and very unfavorable toward Russia. And so people in Ukraine said, screw that. We're not going to let the West come in here and overthrow our government and us just sit back and do nothing. And so in the eastern part of the country, they rebelled in the Donetsk region and elsewhere, and they started voting down in Crimea, which is it's a peninsula, but it's almost an island at the top of the Black Sea. Well, it's extremely strategically important there. But they voted. They had a referendum. The people turned out massive, over 90% of the people turned out to vote, the citizens, and they voted, something like 96% of the people voted to secede from Ukraine, and they formally petitioned Russia to absorb them, to annex their territory so that they could be part of Russia. That was the will of the people, and so that's what happened. But you listen to Western media, and the story is Vladimir Putin took Russian troops and went and invaded Ukraine and stole their territory, completely ignoring the fact that the people were upset because the West had just carried out a coup against their government and replaced them. You know, it's just astounding, honest, what our Western media is telling the American people. And so I said earlier, I'm kind of upset at, you know, how the Americans, whatever, but I can see why it is. It's because you really have to search out all kinds of sources of information, and a lot of it international news, to get a broader picture, because our lying, dishonest mainstream media in America is completely beholden to the New World Order. And if it's not favorable toward them, they won't report it.
And you know, I know some very intelligent people that can't see through this, even though it's so transparent, which amazes me. That tells me that there's something else going on with this mind control thing, because there are some people that are susceptible to this that are very, very intelligent and should not be brainwashed by this. Have you seen this kind of thing yourself?
Yeah. A lot of people are like that. The good thing is that, well, I don't know. Some people are very closed-minded, and it doesn't matter if you sit them down and show them the evidence. They're just going to believe what they have to believe, what they want to believe. But for those who have an open mind, there is so much evidence that can convince an open-minded person to where they will switch their opinion. Mm-hmm. The problem is finding that in a cohesive narrative, because, you know, these are very complex topics, mm-hmm. you know, to go and talk about all this. And so that's one of my main goals on my YouTube channel, is to take these very complex topics like the geopolitics of the Middle East or what happened in Ukraine or Syria, and go through and just go step by step with the evidence, with the documentation. I try and source my claims so that people know it's just not my personal opinion. I show articles, screenshots of the articles from which I'm drawing my information, or the government documents, and explain it. But when you have something like, hey, you want to learn about Ukraine, or would you rather play Candy Crush or watch, you know, binge watch something on Netflix? I mean, it's very, very hard to compete with, you know, what the entertainment out there has to offer. Just we've been dumbed down, I think, as a people through the public education system. We've been taught to listen to, you need to get all your information in 30-second sound bites, and if it goes beyond that, then it's a waste of time, it's too much. Just like we've become an ADD nation, where people have they can't sit and listen for any length of time before they need, it's like a psychological need. They have to switch topics to get to something else. And the other problem, Mark, that I'm concerned about is the polarization of people in how they approach discussion and debate. Mm-hmm. I remember a time in America not too many years ago, you know, a couple decades ago, I guess, when it was normal to listen to what people who totally disagreed with you had to say, and you didn't get mad at them. Right. You just disagreed with them. Exactly. You listen to what they say, and then you'd offer why you think differently, and you still are friends at the end of all that. You have some mutual respect for each other, even if you totally disagree. But these days, if you disagree with someone politically, it's not just that you have a disagreement, it's you're a racist.
Yeah.
If you voted for Trump, you're a racist and you hate women. You know, or whatever it is. You know, it makes no sense. It makes no sense. Donald Trump is not the least bit racist.
No, he isn't.
But even people are out there with the Trump's a racist stuff, and it's such a cheap way of sullying public discourse and dialogue to the point that we all become stupid for it because no one is talking about real ideas. We just take the cheap way out and shut people up by shaming them, either calling them homophobic or calling them Jew haters or whatever the charge happens to be, because you just don't know enough yourself about a topic to discuss it. So it's easier just to say someone's anti-Semitic rather than engage them in an actual discussion about why you think it's a problem that Israel is doing this or this or this. You know, it's just automatic. If you don't agree with Israel, you hate Jews. Or if you support whatever, you're a Muslim lover or who knows what. It's just, I don't know, Mark. That's why shows like yours, I think, are so useful and so important, because, like, you just talk. And you let people share their ideas, and people who listen to an hour of a show like this, thank God for them. Well, we need a been full of people like that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's a very nice compliment. I was watching a video, and I forget the guy's name, and it's probably good that I forgot. And the show's called The Young Turks, and this fellow was talking with Jesse Ventura, and after he talked, and he was talking about Hillary Clinton, and I'd love to hear your perspective on Hillary, but I think I know what it is because you do a lot of homework, and this poor fella, a very nice person, some way or another, just had not done his homework with Hillary, so. To me, it was kind of almost like, I don't know, mind control, or it was just this weird experience of seeing this fellow. And I think there are probably a lot of people, maybe half of the people in the mainstream media, who haven't done their homework and have just shut down because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you look at Hillary Clinton and her background with Bill and the whole Mena, Arkansas, and the whole running drugs thing and on and on and on, we had a dyed-in-the-wool criminal that just ran for president. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Oh, no correction there, Mark. I remembered Hillary Clinton very well from the 90s, from the when she was in there as first lady. And we hated her back then. Not even Democrats tried defending Hillary too much back then. She was just a monster even back then. And there were the early scandals. There was the strange death of, you know, the fake suicide of Vince Foster,
right,
lover-in-law partner. There was the whole Whitewater. It was just so much. And nobody liked her. And so when Bill Clinton left office, even though he was popular, his wife was not. So then a few years passed, and there's talk of Hillary running for president. And I thought, what a joke. No one's going to buy that. But sure enough, she ends up in there. And she had accumulated so many more crimes over the years, primarily through the Clinton Foundation and all of her pay-for-play garbage, where she was taking millions of dollars from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and doing all of these things, using her power in the State Department, the favoritism. Not only that, but Hillary's, her and Bill, what they did to Haiti, the way that they financially raped that country. And actually, Hillary Clinton's broke the law by using her power in the State Department to help get Laura Silsby out of the Haiti jail. Laura Silsby was a convicted child trafficker that had gone down there. And anyway, so Hillary was just a monster. But what happens is we now live in a time where all of social media is an echo chamber. you get more of what you already believe. Facebook algorithms, YouTube algorithms, all of these things are designed to take a look at what you already like. What are you clicking like on? And then we're going to give you more of that, and we are going to take away the other stuff. And so you end up in this virtual reality where you think that you're living in the real world, but all that's happening is you think, I have a neighbor who's like this. He was just astonished that Trump won. He thought it was going to be like a, you know, blowout, 60-70% victory for Hillary. But he was so out of touch with the fact that outside of his little world, other people have different viewpoints. And that's what social media does, is it surrounds you with people who think your way, people who say things you agree with, and you get fed that, and you get disconnected. And so when someone else comes along and says something that's totally opposite from what you think they're a nut. Like, boy, that guy's a conspiracy theorist. He thinks Trump has a chance of winning or whatever. And so Hillary, that's what happened with Hillary supporters. And it's also happened with Trump supporters. You know, it happens both ways. But yeah, people supporting Hillary, I could not believe it. And I was glad to see that there were a lot of Democrats who recognized this time around that Hillary was a crook and they abandoned her. I wasn't crazy that, you know, the alternative was a socialist, but still, there were enough people that pulled away from Hillary and supported Bernie Sanders that it was nice to see that there was at least a small segment of people out there who were saying, we just can't do this. This woman's awful. Even though she's our party nominee, we can't support her.
You know, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think Hillary or Bill will ever be prosecuted. What do you think?
No, absolutely not. They're too well protected. They have too much dirt on too many people, and if they go down, they'll take others down with them. And I said from the beginning, all during the campaign season, when Trump was out there saying, we're going to lock Hillary up and getting the crowd fired up, there was just no way at all that this was going to happen. It just, that's not how it works. Trump was just too close to the Clintons. Really, when you, the truth is these high-level people, most of them are crooks. If you're up there and you get a party nomination, if you're not already a crook, odds are they're going to take control and turn you into one. Or they're going to do like they did to Reagan and try and assassinate him 2 months into his presidency so that George Herbert Walker Bush could take over. But, you know, Reagan did go through a shift. He backed off on some of the things that he was going to push for, and he kind of learned his place. He still made a mark, but he was not the man after that. Mm-hmm. And that's how it goes. And so Trump is in there, and I see several good things that he's done. I love that he pulled out of TPP, and I do agree with him on immigration. I believe in a strong national defense and defense of our borders, and I defend Trump against a lot of the hateful rhetoric that is sent against him. But when it comes to things like foreign policy, there's virtually nothing that I agree with Donald Trump on when it comes to foreign policy. You know, so but you know that's just how I am. I look at things and I feel secure enough and that I can say I like this part of a person and I dislike that part. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. You don't have to be a total automaton that loves every single thing about Hillary Clinton or about Trump. You can find some middle ground. Sure. And I considered voting for Trump. I decided in the end not to, but, you know, I thought about it because certainly there was going to be a war with Russia if Hillary got in because she was pushing hard for that.
Yep.
But in the end, I decided not to vote for Trump. But that's nothing new with me. I haven't cast. I've been doing write-ins for president since 2000.
Hmm.
Back in 2000, the 2000 election, I was the state campaign manager for Steve Forbes. He was the billionaire running for president against John McCain and George W. Bush, and ever since then, I vote in all elections, including the local elections. But when it comes to the presidential ticket, I haven't been satisfied with any of the candidates from either of the major parties. So I either vote third party or I do a write-in.
Hmm. Do you think Trump is controlled by the Zionists or perhaps the neocons?
I think that Trump is independent to some degree in that he, what really comes first is what's best for Trump and Trump's interests. And he will use anybody along the way until it no longer suits him. And he'll abandon somebody in a heartbeat. And he talks about that in The Art of the Deal. I've read his book a few times. This is no secret. He's very open about his tactics. As far as whether or not he's controlled, I think that at the moment he has found that he's under great influence by Ivanka and Jared. Jared is a diehard Zionist, so much so that even Benjamin Netanyahu is such a close friend of the Kushner family that he's actually stayed in their home a few times, and he's actually slept in Jared Kushner's bed. You know, Kushner wasn't in it. He went to a different room, but that's how close that the Netanyahu is to the Kushner family. So Trump is going right along with it. The whole thing with recognizing Jerusalem as the capital is very much an indication that he's very, very supportive of the Zionist ambition. My bigger concern is at this point his relationship with the Saudis, because they're out of control. They're nuts, absolutely nuts.
We didn't really get a chance to talk about that.
Yeah,
you know, we burn up a whole hour and we never really. That's a topic you've studied a whole lot, haven't you?
Yeah.
Gosh, we'll have to do that on another show, and maybe we won't wait so long.
Sure, yeah, anytime, Mark. I'd be glad to come back and talk.
That's awesome. And tell people about your websites again and any other stuff you wanted to kind of close down with.
Sure. So folks can find me at two primary places. One is YouTube. That's youtube.com/prepare333. I'd love you to subscribe to the channel. I'm doing a lot on Las Vegas right now. My website is blackstoneintel.com. Blackstoneintel.com.
Is that two L's or one L?
One L after okay. Intel. Okay. Blackstone Intel. Short for Blackstone Intelligence Network is the name of my company, but
sweet. Blackstone Intel. Thanks, Jake. It's a pleasure. Great conversation.
Mark, I really enjoyed talking with you. Every time I talk with you, it's enjoyable. I appreciate it.
Have a great evening, sir. Talk to you later.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.